Book of Hebrews. What is the Book of Hebrews about, and why was it written? And that's what we're really kind of discussing in this short mini-series called Hebrews Unplugged. As I mentioned, we've been going in this mini-study for probably a little over a month now. So if you want to get more information about the study, go to my graftedin.com website, and there you can find the links to the short studies that we did. They're under the More Lessons link at graftedin.com, and when you scroll down, you'll see the SQSA live study links for the MP3 audios, the iTunes podcast that I uploaded, and we're on week 55 now, so I think we started talking about the Book of Hebrews way back in week 50, if I remember. So 50 going forward is the Hebrews Unplugged. Just fast forward through the audio to about halfway mark, and that's where we start talking about the Book of Hebrews. Let me just, before I jump into chapter 9 and look at those two verses, let me just pull up a website that's familiar to many people. It's gotquestions.org. A very well put together website, I might add. It's a very good resource if you're talking about general, overall questions and answers about the Bible as a whole, very comprehensive in that regard. But they have a little section on the Book of Hebrews, and let me just scroll down to the paragraph where the writer talks about what was the purpose of the writing of the book. And here's what the author there says. This is representative of your average Christian viewpoint to the Book of Hebrews, and this is going to help me launch into my own study tonight. Purpose of the writing. Here's what the gotquestions.org says. Quote, "The late Dr. Walter Martin, founder of the Christian Research Institute and writer of the best-selling book Kingdom of the Cults, quipped in his usual tongue-in-cheek manner that, listen carefully, the Book of Hebrews was written by a Hebrew to other Hebrews, telling the Hebrews to stop acting like Hebrews." Did you catch that? It's written by a Hebrew to tell other Hebrews, telling the Hebrews to stop acting like Hebrews. In truth, many of the earliest Jewish believers were slipping back into the rites and rituals of Judaism in order to escape the mounting persecution. This letter, then, is an exhortation for those persecuted believers to continue in the grace of Jesus Christ. Okay, so if you didn't catch it, typically most Christians are going to be taught at the seminary level and down that the writer to the Book of Hebrews was very worried that his readership, the Hebrews, the readers of his book, were going to keep returning to animal sacrifices instead of turning to Christ, and that they're going to go back to Judaism instead of turning to Christianity, and that they're going to turn into Torah observance and the law of Moses instead of turning away from that and turning into the law of Christ. And therefore, the writer to the Book of Hebrews has to warn them over and over again about the supremacy of Messiah to Moses, about the supremacy of Christ's atonement to the animal atonement, and about the supremacy of the lasting new covenant that we're going to study tonight, as opposed to the old covenant, which was broken by Israel and therefore had to be discarded. So that's your typical view of the Book of Hebrews. But as I found, studying through the book, that's not really the best way to interpret the book. Instead, there is a contrast in the book, but it's not a contrast between the old, which is bad, and the new, which is good. That's the traditional, historic Christian way of interpreting the Book of Hebrews, is that the old covenant is bad with all of its legalism, its trappings, its vestiges, you know, the old Levitical priestly system, the old atonement, the old Mosaic way of keeping the law, the outward letter of keeping the law, the old physical circumcision, the old animal sacrifices, all of that is old, and that's old covenant, and therefore that is being replaced. It's to borrow the language that the writer actually states in the end of chapter 7, it's growing old and ready to vanish away altogether. That's how Christians interpret the latter few verses of chapter 7. And the new that the writer talks about in starting around verse 8 of chapter 8 and going down through verse 12, which is the longest continuous quote from the Tanakh pulled into the New Testament. The writer quotes from the book of Jeremiah chapter 31 and explains that there's a new covenant. And of course, again, most Christians are taught that the new replaces the old. Therefore, this new must be the New Testament / New Covenant, ratified, of course, by Yeshua's blood at his last Passover and by his death on the cross and the sending of the Spirit at Acts chapter 2, Shavuot. And therefore, it's only natural that the writers to the New Testament, which primarily is Paul, are going to also echo the same sentiment that the old is done away with and we're no longer under the law, we're under grace. Romans chapter 6, around verse 14 and 15 and 16, somewhere around there. We're not under the law, we're under grace. So, but what gives? How do we really interpret this? Is it a contrast between the bad versus the good? The bad being the old Mosaic system and the new versus the new being the Messianic New Covenant. Well, let's take a look. Hebrews chapter 9 is where we're going to turn tonight. Let me just pull it up. And we're not going to read the entire book or any such the entire chapter or any such thing. What I have been doing is selectively reading certain verses so that we can get an idea of the context. And we studied Hebrews 9 last week, and we stopped basically at verse 13, where 13 and 14, where the writer is introducing this concept to the readers of sacrificial atonement, and to state it succinctly, Hebrews 9, 13, and 14 sets up a logical principle based on the lesser to the greater that we call in Latin a fortiori. A fortiori. The letter A, new word, F-O-R-T-I-O-R-I, a fortiori, or a fortiori. In Hebrew, we call this Kal vachomer, light from heavy. And it's a logical principle based on the truth of a lesser principle, which, when applied to a greater principle, has a greater application. The idea, for instance, that if a grown man can jump 50 feet straight into the air based on his strong leg muscles, I'm using this as an example. If a grown man could physically jump 50 feet straight into the air and you could witness it and see it, then if you were to ask him, hey, can you jump 10 feet into the air? Well, that's a ridiculous question, because he would say, obviously, now listen to my answer, obviously, if I can jump 50 feet straight into the air, how much easier would it be for me to jump 10 feet straight into the air? Do you understand the logical application of the fact that because he can accomplish the greater, then how much easier would it be for him to accomplish the lesser? So it's the same type of logical principle. If the lesser is true, then the greater is true with even more force, or if the greater is true, then the lesser is also true with the greater force. So that's the principle that is being established in verse 13 and 14. If the blood of bulls and goats and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of a heifer sanctify, they most certainly do in the mind of the writer of the Hebrews, sanctify for the purification of the flesh, which they did. They weren't ineffective. They were, in fact, effectual. They worked. How much more, the first few words of verse 14, how much more, that signifies our a fortiori logic or kal vachomer language, how much more, and with equal force, will the blood of Messiah, through the eternal Spirit, offered himself without blemish to God, purify, right, that this answers to the word sanctify above, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God. So I mentioned last week, in order for the logic to hold together, the lesser has to be true, which is the animal sacrifices. The effectual nature of the cleansing of the animal sacrifices has to work, albeit on a limited purification of the flesh level. In other words, it was for ritual atonement, but it still has to work in order for the logical principle being applied to the greater, which is the blood of Messiah. So that's the lesser to the greater. It's unfortunate that many Christian theologians today teach that the Old Testament system was ineffectual in that it didn't work, it didn't provide any atonement, it failed, it merely covered sins, it merely swept sins under the rug, it merely put them behind God's chair so he didn't see them anymore, but yet they were still there. But that's not, in fact, the picture that the writer to the book of Hebrews is painting, and it disagrees with the entirety of the Levitical instructions and language that we would read if we were to go back and read the entire book of Leviticus as a whole. All right, so having said all that, we're going to move now tonight into verse 15, 16, and 17. I said two verses, but I think I can do this in three. All right, so I've got about 5 minutes left. I'm going to take my time. I may go a little bit over for those of you with me in the live class because I took a little longer in the short questions section. So if you'll permit me, I might go 5 or 10 minutes over, but I'll see if I can hit verse 15, 16, and 17, and that's all I'll deal with tonight because this is going to take a lot to deal with anyway. All right, verse 15. Let me actually read these three verses. Therefore, right, kaidia tuta. This is a concluding statement for the writer. It's a kind of a semi-conclusion that he's bringing to the previous argument, and that is going to position us to begin studying this concept of blood atonement and the necessity of the death of something. All right, so listen up very carefully. Therefore, the writer says in verse 15, he is the mediator of a new covenant so that, right, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance. Since a death, right, he's going to be start talking about death, since a death has occurred, in the Greek would be a thanatou, right, the word here, since a death, which is not the same word as death that we're going to read down later on when we get to verse 16. It's actually a different Greek word, nekrois, from where we get the word necro or necro something. Those are related to the Greek word for death. But since a death, it's probably better to read this word thanatou, since a sacrificial death. Since a sacrifice or a slaughtering or something to that effect. Since a death has occurred, that redeems them, right, the parties, from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. Verse 16. For where a will is involved, we really have to look at the Greek on this one tonight, guys. For where will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. Verse 17. For will takes effect only at death, since it is not enforced as long as the one who made it is alive. All right. All right, strap yourselves in, because this is going to be a little rocky. It's going to be a little difficult for me to explain this and articulate this. And if I were you, I highly recommend that you actually go back and listen to what I'm about to say a few different times, because it's going to take a little while to get it out. All right, verse 15. Therefore, he, speaking of Yeshua, is the mediator of a new covenant, right? Diathekes kaines in the Greek. He's the mediator of this new covenant, and of course, we're instantly reminded of this new covenant that the writer already mentioned in chapter 8, verse 8 through verse 12, and he's going to mention again in the next chapter, verse 10. So this new covenant, which is, of course, language already given to us in Jeremiah chapter 31, this new covenant is something that we know that Jesus brings into the picture. And it's necessary in order to, so that those who are covenant members may receive the promised eternal inheritance. That's what he says in verse 15. This is substitutionary language, as we already know from Sunday school lessons, because he says, since a death has occurred that redeems him from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. Now, basically, verse 15 is a summary statement of what he's going to explain in the next 6, 7, or 8 verses. And this is the summary, so I'll give it to you, the summary right up front. In ancient Near Eastern way of thinking, particularly with Israel and God, when it came to a covenant, there was a covenant party, a covenant ceremony. When I say party, I mean a covenant reenactment. A covenant ceremony that involved at least three chief ingredients. It involved a party A, it involved B, party B, and involved C, the animals. And what took place, and we know about this from reading Genesis chapter 15, we can actually see this between God, Abraham, and the animals. And this is also typical of most ancient Near Eastern covenants to include the one with Israel, but not exclusively the one with Israel. But we see this demonstrated for us in the Genesis 15 narrative. It's that two parties would enter into a covenant with one another, and they would take animals, and they would cut the animals right down the middle or in pieces, and they would separate the animals so that there was a walkway between the two animals, and the two parties, party A and party B, would together walk or pass through the slain parts of those animals and the blood that was sprinkled between those two. And this was a symbolic gesture that demonstrated to one another that if I, you know, the A and B were saying to one another, if I, for my part, renege on the covenant, if I break my part of the covenant, whatever oath that we're taking with one another, whatever, promissory contract that we're making with one another, the terms and stipulations of the covenant. If I break my part of the covenant, then I, for my part, will be as the animals that are here in front of me. In other words, I too must die. I will be like these animals. I deserve death if I break my part of the covenant. In other words, so strongly am I going to commit myself to keeping the part of the covenant under pain of death if I violate it. That was the language and the symbolism that was being portrayed by your ancient Near Eastern covenant enactment that I'm describing, that we can read about in Genesis chapter 15. And we can also read about a similar one in Jeremiah 34, which is interesting that this takes place three chapters after our Jeremiah 31:31 New Covenant passage. But let me read this for you real quick. In Jeremiah 34, starting in verse 13, the people of Israel are reminded by God that they entered into a covenant with God at Sinai. And then in Jeremiah's day, there's this occurrence where some slaves need to be set free because they had been indebted to the slave owner for 6 years. This was kind of what we might call an employer-employee arrangement. It wasn't really slavery in that sense, but it was a contractual agreement between an employer and employee. We could call it slave. I mean, that's the language it's using, but it's not exactly slavery. The Bible doesn't really condone slavery, is what I'm trying to say. It's a contractual agreement between the indentured servant and the owner of that indentured servant. But the Torah put limitations on this contractual agreement between these two parties, between the employer and the employee, and that the slave could only work for 6 years, and that the seventh year he had to go free, he had to be set free. And these are detailed in the Torah as well. So there's this situation that happens in Jeremiah's day in verse chapter 34, where the slave owners were reneging on their part to set the slaves, the employers free, right? And they were actually going back and getting them again. They were saying, oh, you're free, but then they would actually go and bring them back and make them indentured servants all over again, effectually enslaving them. And so God was displeased because at a smaller level, they were breaking the arrangement as regards indentured servitude. But on a bigger picture, this represented a violation of the Torah as a whole, because they were breaking a part of the Torah, a set of laws that was contained within the Torah. So it's within that context that Jeremiah says in chapter 34, verse 13, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I myself made a covenant with your fathers when I brought them out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of Israel, house of slavery, saying, at the end of 7 years, each of you must set free the fellow Hebrew who has been sold to you and has served you 6 years. You must set him free from your service, but your fathers did not listen to me or incline their ears to me. You recently, right, as in recent to the day of Jeremiah, you recently repented and did what was right in my eyes by proclaiming liberty to each to his neighbor, and you made a covenant before me. This covenant that's spoken about in verse 15 is a recent one right here in the book of Jeremiah. It's not to be mistakenly applied to the covenant that was made hundreds or thousands of years ago at Sinai. That's not what Jeremiah is referring to. He's talking about a covenant recent here. You made a covenant before me in the house that is called by my name. But then you turned around and profaned my name when each of you took back his male and female slaves, whom you had set free according to their desire, and you brought them into subjection to be your slaves. Now listen to this. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, you have not obeyed me by proclaiming liberty, every one to his brother and to his neighbor. Behold, I proclaim to you liberty to the sword, to pestilence, and to famine, declares the Lord. I will make you a hoarder to all the kings of the earth. So God is upset that the Israelites of Jeremiah's day have gone back on their word of setting a covenant. But look at these next few verses. Notice what God references. Okay, you ready? Jeremiah 34, verse 18. And the men, speaking of the ones in Jeremiah's day, and the men who transgressed my covenant and did not keep the terms of the covenant that they made before me, I will make them like the calf that they cut in two and pass between its parts. Look at verse 19. The officials of Judah, the officials of Jerusalem, the eunuchs, the priests, and all the people of the land who passed between the parts of the calf, and verse 20, and I will give them into the hand of their enemies and into the hand of those who seek their lives. Their dead bodies shall be food for the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth. Now, let's go back to Hebrews chapter 9. What's going on? In the book of Jeremiah, the writer is describing this covenant ceremony that we read about in Genesis 15, where two parties enter into a covenant arrangement with one another, and they lay out animals, and they cut the animals open, and there's blood present. and therefore the parties passing through the animals, like it says here in verse 18, I will make them like the calf that they cut into and pass between its parts, right? So God is describing the ceremony that the Israelites would have been aware of already, because Abraham already went through that same ceremony. We're not going to go back and read Genesis 15. You do it on your own. But that is the ceremony that the writer to the book of Hebrews here in Hebrews 9, verses 16 and 17 is alluding to when he says that a death has occurred in verse 15, a death that occurred that redeems from the transgressions committed on the first covenant. Now, the summary of what he's about to describe is verse 15. There was a death that occurred that redeemed them. Listen up very, very carefully. According to the covenant arrangement between God and Israel, right, that took place on Mount Sinai in Exodus chapter 24. We read that, and we're going to read about this later on in the book of Hebrews here in chapter 9 as well, starting in verse 18 and moving down into verse 19 and 20 and 21 as well, where basically Moses takes blood and and it's from the animals that were sacrificed, and presumably they were cut in two, but we don't read about that. But we do read about the blood, and that's the important part of that we need to read about in Exodus chapter 24. Moses takes his blood and he sprinkles it on the people, and he sprinkles it on the furniture of the tabernacle, and he sprinkles it on the tablets as well. And he says, this is the blood that represents the blood of the covenant. And the people say, all that you have said that we will do. They say this to God. And basically, Israel is saying in typical covenant fashion that if we violate our part of the covenant, may we be like the animals that were slain. May we also be slain. So what's taking place here, people? What's taking place is that the people are saying the animals represent us. The animals represent us in that the animals are slain in representative fashion, that if we violate our part of the covenant, we too will die just like the animals are actually dying before our very eyes. And the blood that we are taking upon ourselves is our way of saying that we are taking on the covenant responsibility. We are taking on death itself in response to us violating the covenant, if that comes to be the case. So in verse 15, he says, a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions, which means that if either party A or party B violates their part of the covenant, then death must take place. That's the important point that the writer to the book of Hebrews is trying to make, is that if a transgression takes place, then the next logical and expected action that must take place is that a death must take place. Now, who are the two covenant parties? God and Israel. So let's begin to ask some very important questions. Did God break his side of the covenant? The answer is no. Therefore, did Israel break their side of the covenant? The answer is yes. We already know, because the writer told us explicitly in chapter 8, verse 8, for finding fault with them. Therefore, because Israel broke their part of the covenant, a death must occur, because that's the covenant agreement that they entered into way back at Sinai. Remember, when they allowed the blood to be sprinkled on them, they said, hey, all that you've said we will do, we are symbolically bearing death, and yet they did violate the covenant, and therefore a death must occur. But instead of Israel dying, God instead representatively sent his son to die in their place. So Messiah becomes the substitutionary death instead of Israel dying. Corporately speaking, Israel should have died. But corporately speaking, Messiah took on that corporate death as the sacrificial animal, and he stepped into that place. And therefore, that's why the writer says in verse 15, since a death has occurred, past tense, has occurred that redeemed them, right? It's the payment for the breach of contract, right? By sinning, Israel incurred a debt of what? A debt of death. A debt of death. And only death can pay for death, or alternately, life can pay for life. The equation works either way. But the currency must be the same. You must pay death with death, or you must pay life with life. Life for life, or death for death. It has to be the same currency. So therefore, because Israel violated the covenant, death was their wage, right? The soul that sinneth must die. The wages of sin is death. And therefore, corporately speaking, Israel needed to pay their debt with death. Well, there were only two choices. Either A, all of corporate Israel must die, because they are the ones who corporately entered into a covenant arrangement with God at Sinai. Or B, just like the animal sacrificial system was teaching Israel, they must have a representative death, an animal substitute. And that's what the whole sacrificial system was teaching them, is that substitutionary atonement was possible with God, where an individual, instead of him dying, an animal took his place. In this case, Yeshua was that substitutionary atonement, which by paying the debt on their behalf, released them from the debt that was owed. That's why it says it redeemed them from the transgressions committed on the first covenant. So that's the context of verse 15, which moves us into verse 16. He's going to explain now, for where a will is involved. Now, this is extremely unfortunate that the writer uses the word, that the translator uses the word will. I think almost every major translation in verse 16 says will. But it's the same Greek word that we saw earlier. It's diatheke, which we saw up here earlier in verse 15. And the writer to the book of Hebrews uses the same Greek word diatheke throughout his letter because he understands that this is covenant. The Hebrew equivalent is the word brit. So he's not talking about a will or a last will and testament. But in the Hebrew mind, the word brit, which answers to the Greek word diatheke, is the concept of the cutting of animals with the shedding of blood, which is representative of the death that must be shown if a party fails to keep their covenant arrangement. So blood represents death, which represents a violation of a covenant. In other words, the blood represents the payment. The blood equals atonement, to put it in plain language. So in the mind of a Hebrew, covenant is associated with blood and animal deaths and things like that. But in the Greek worldview, culturally speaking, animal sacrifices wasn't represented. Covenants weren't represented by animal sacrifices. Covenants were represented by pieces of paper and ink, contracts, and written things. And thus, the phrase will and testament is a Greek way of approaching the concept. Thus, the word diatheke is the word for contract or covenant or will. It's not the wrong word being chosen. Rather, it's a different cultural concept when we talk about Greek. So to a Greek, when you start talking about diatheke, in their mind, they don't start picturing animals and blood and things like that. They start picturing legal contracts and pen and ink and people who can be legal witnesses and power of attorney and all that type of thing, right? It's a very legal process. It doesn't involve animals at all. It just involves people who are legal representatives of whatever will or contract is being drawn up in ink and paper. So that's their mindset. But it's the same Greek word, diatheke. So unfortunately, translators think that when we get to verse 16 and 17, that Jesus is actually drawing up a last will and testament that would not become effective until Jesus died. That's kind of a Western way of viewing last will and testament, where according to the way we think of it in the West, the parents bequeath their heritage, right, all their belongings to their children, and they say, when I die, you get the family inheritance, but you don't get it until I die. And therefore, it's a last will and testament that goes into effect only after the death of the parents, and then the children can receive the inheritance at the reading of the will and things like that. So that's the Western way of interpreting these verses, but listen very carefully. That's not the way the writer to the book of Hebrews is approaching this topic. His approach is not Western slash Greco. It's actually Hebraic. So we shouldn't interpret this word diatheke as will. It's not a last will and testament. To be sure, even in the first century, a last will and testament from the Greek perspective, which didn't involve blood, still didn't require the death of a parent for a child to be able to enjoy the benefits of that particular inheritance. Case in point, Luke chapter 15, Yeshua tells a parable about the prodigal son. You guys know the story. The prodigal son says to his father, the younger son, the foolish one, give me my inheritance. What inheritance is he talking about? He's talking about that which the father has already promised to his children. But the younger foolish son says, give it to me now. I don't want to wait for you to die or any such thing. I want it now. And if the inheritance was dependent upon the death of the father, then the father should have said to the son, sorry, son, you can't have any of it until I die. You're just going to have to wait. In which case, probably Yeshua would have been explaining that the son probably murdered the father and took the inheritance by force. But that's not the way the story plays out. You guys know how it works. The father actually says to the younger foolish son, okay, here you go. You can have it. And what does the young son do? He takes it and he goes and spends it foolishly. And the older son is, of course, the one who didn't take the inheritance. But the younger son is the one who spends it foolishly and then realizes later on after he spent everything that the father gave him that he's living in like a pig, right? And he desires to be back in the family again, so he returns home. Thus, the parable named Prodigal Son. He returns and the father receives him back into the family. But the whole point I'm trying to bring up is that nobody dies in the story. So if the last will and testament of a first century was dependent upon the death of the one who was drawing the last will and testament up, then Yeshua's story wouldn't have had any traction with his readers. They would have said, wait a minute, Jesus, your story doesn't make sense because the father didn't die in the story. Yeah, well, the reason why Yeshua didn't have to kill off the father in his parable is because it wasn't necessary even in first century last wills and testaments. We just needed someone who had the power of attorney or the power of a legal enforcement to actually witness, maybe a legal witness, to actually witness the law, the contract being written up. And then the children could enjoy the last will, they could enjoy the heritage even while the parents were still alive. In other words, there wasn't the death that needed to take place. So that's one big reason why last will and testament is a very poor choice of words and a wrong way of interpreting these verses. So here's what I believe is a better way to interpret these verses. Verse 16. What the writer says is, for where a covenant is involved, not a will, where a covenant is involved, and he has in mind the idea of two parties and the slaying of animals and the presence of blood. Where a covenant is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. Now, when he says death, he's talking about one of the two parties. And when he's talking about established there, he uses the word death is thanaton, and established is the word pharisthai here in the Greek. The death of the one who made it must be established. The Greek word pharisthai literally means to carry. We translate it as established here in the ESV, but it really means to bear, to carry, or to be demonstrated by showing someone. Meaning, what the writer is trying to say is that where a covenant is involved, the representative death of the party who entered into covenant agreement must be shown by the presence of the blood of the animals and by the agreement that the party is taking on representatively death itself if he should violate the covenant. Did I lose anyone? In other words, when we're talking about cutting a covenant in the mind of the writer of the Hebrews, which is tied to the biblical way of cutting covenants, the party agrees to die symbolically, agrees to die in reality, but it's symbolized by the death of the real animals. So the animals die in reality. They really die that day, and their blood is really poured out. But symbolically, the person says, hey, just like these animals died, may it be upon me also to bear death that if I break my part of the covenant. In other words, if I break my part, I too need to die. But how am I supposed to keep my part of the agreement if I just die right now with the animals? So that doesn't make any sense. So nobody's dying right there on the spot. Go back to Genesis 15 and read it all over again. Party A, God. Party B, Abraham. And ingredient C, the animals. Three ingredients. A, B, and the animals. Ask yourself a very important question. Did anybody die that day? Did God die? No. Did Abraham die? No. Who died? The animals died. Okay, there we have it. So the death that took place in the covenant is the animals. And the representative death is by the parties A and B, should one of the parties fail to keep their part of the arrangement. In reality, In a perfect world, if neither A nor B broke their part of the arrangement, then nobody had to die after that. Only the animals died. Neither A nor B died after that. That's the optimal way for an arrangement to take place. And in fact, when we read ancient Near Eastern documentation, that really did take place in certain cases. If you made an arrangement with someone that was very short term and you kept your part of the agreement, then nobody needed to die because you fulfilled the party terms of the agreement whenever it expired. But when in Israel's case, we know that they failed to keep their part of the arrangement. So therefore, from God's perspective, somebody had to pay the debt that was incurred because of the transgression. So that's why he says in verse 16, for where a covenant is involved, the death of the one who made it must be represented by him taking on the agreement to die if he himself breaks the agreement. It doesn't mean he needs to die. It just means he needs to agree to die if he breaks it. So a symbolic death must take place on his part, which answers to the physical death of the animals themselves. That's verse 16. And the word death there, thanaton, is actually in the singular. This is going to become very important in the Greek. It's a singular death. For where a whale is involved, the death singular of the one singular who made it must be established. But when we get to verse 17, he says, for a covenant, not a will, for a covenant takes effect only at death. The word death here is not the same as used above. In verse 16, it's the word thanaton, and it's a singular word, death. But in verse 17, it's the word nekrois, which is not only a different word altogether, it's an adjective, whereas up above it's a noun. But in verse 17, diatheke gar epi nekrois, it's a adjective, and it's a plural adjective, right? It's an adjective in the plural, meaning for where a will takes effect only at deaths, plural. Now, deaths of what or whom? I'll just tell you the answer. A covenant takes effect only upon multiple deaths or goes into effect of the deaths. That's why some translations say men instead of man, because they recognize that the Greek word death here, the adjective, is a plural. What the writer is trying to say is that a will or a covenant takes effect only at the deaths of animals, not the deaths of party A or B. Did you catch that? The covenant is brought into reality upon the death or deaths of the animals, plural, not the deaths of party A or B. It's not that God or Israel has to die in order for the covenant to be brought into reality. Rather, it's the deaths of the animal. Since, he goes to explain, it is not in force as long as the party, either A or B, who made it is representatively still alive, meaning they have not taken on the representative death like is being demonstrated by the animals. So, in plain language, I believe I'm trying to make this plain and try not to prolong it, although I am going over for those of you in live class, I apologize. Verse 17 is trying to say that just like the covenant that God made with Abraham, in which God passed through the pieces of the animal and Abraham was asleep, the animals died, but neither God nor Abraham had to die in order for the covenant to be brought into reality. So it is a covenant that is now begun. And therefore, God in chapter 17 of Genesis can speak to Abraham in terms of a covenant that has already been brought into effect, because God initiated the covenant by passing through the pieces himself and by slaying the animals. So a covenant takes effect only at the death of animals. That's what the first clause is saying in our verse. Since it is not in force, meaning it hasn't been brought into the picture, as long as either party has failed to accept the responsibility of dying if they also break the covenant. So, are you guys misunderstanding what I'm trying to say here? By slaying the animals, the parties are saying, okay, let's start this thing up. Let's agree. The covenant parties A and B are saying, okay, the minute we slay these animals, both of us are accepting representatively the death as well. We are saying, by looking at the blood here, that the blood represents our own death. Neither one of us have to die unless we violate our part of the covenant. But as long as we keep our side of the covenant, we can live as well. It's the animal that dies. He dies, and the blood is his death, but it represents us dying if if we violate. So the covenant itself requires the death of the animal to initiate the covenant. Catch that? But we have to come full circle now. If there is a breach of covenant, then death must take place again, a second time, to pay the debt incurred by the breach of contract. Are you following me? So there's really two deaths that are envisioned. The first is the physical death of the animals and the blood, and the second is a representative death of the people, or which would actually result in a real death should one of the parties violate their side of the agreement. So two deaths would really occur. First death initiates the covenant or brings it into reality, and the second death, should there be a violation, the second death actually makes the payment to close the contract out. To bring the payment into full payment, to bring the covenant to full payment, because a debt is now on the books. And it's an unpaid debt until a death takes place. And because there's two parties, one of the two parties, and it's understandable, it's the one who violated, that is the person who has to die. So if it's between two men, A and B, then the first death that takes place initiates the covenant. And there's the blood of the animals, and the blood represents the second death that would take place should either A or B violate their part of the agreement. And so let's say in the course of a year or a month or a year, party B violates this covenant. Let's say it's two men. Let's say it's not God and man. It's two men. Should party B violate the covenant, when then party A needs to find party B and say, okay, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to die. Your death is going to pay the debt that has been incurred by your violation of the covenant. And so what, party B dies? And then the contract is done. It's complete. And therefore, a new contract could take place between party A and somebody, the other person, because party B is dead. No more contracts for him, right? He violated his terms of the contract. And just like he promised that, hey, if I violate my part of the contract, then I, like these animals, have to die. Well, sure enough, he bore death representatively. And therefore, because he violated, then he too must die. So that's what's going on here. A covenant takes place. A covenant is brought into reality, verse 17, only at the death of animals. That's why the word deaths is in plural. Since it is not enforced as long as the party A or party B does not agree to the terms of taking on the penalty of death themselves. If party A or B says, no, I refuse to enter into this covenant arrangement, well, then the contract is not effectual. That's what he means when he says it is not in force as long as the party who's entering into agreement refuses to agree to the terms, refuses to bear pain of death. That's what he means by made it is alive. It doesn't mean that he has to die himself, right? That's not how the covenants work. So that is how we should better understand verse 16 and 17. And in closing tonight, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull a quote from Tim Haig's commentary to the book of Hebrews on these two verses. And he does this nice little paraphrase of these two verses. And I think it'll help us understand what I'm trying to convey here. So let me find it here. Maybe this will help you understand. Okay, so I'm going to read. Let's see if I can highlight it here. There we go. For those of you with me in live class, I'm reading from Tim Haig's commentary to Hebrews chapter 9. He says, we may therefore give an explanatory translation of verses 16 and 17 as follows. So let me read it first for you real quick. 16 and 17 out of the ESV reads, for where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established, for a will takes effect only at death, since it is not enforced as long as the one who made it is alive. Again, most translators are going to tell you that this will is a last will and testament that we would think about from a Western perspective, and it is effectual only at Christ's death, and therefore it doesn't go into effect before then, and therefore it's necessary for Messiah to die because the new covenant could not come into effect until Jesus died. Therefore, it's proof positive that the old covenant is not only done away with, but there was no salvation offered to anyone in the old covenant because there was no new covenant ratified until Yeshua died on the cross. That's traditional Christian exegesis of the passage for the most part, right? Which, of course, I disagree with. Here's what Tim Haig has to say. We may therefore give this explanatory verse. Quote, for where there is a covenant, the one who ratifies it must represent himself as dead in the covenant ratification ceremony. For a covenant is only guaranteed on the basis of the oath taken in regard to sacrificial animals. For it is never valid while the one making the covenant lives, that is, has failed to represent himself as dead in the event he acts falsely against the covenant. Did you catch Tim Higgs' paraphrase? It's similar to the way I interpret the verse. We arrived at the same conclusion. It's that the writer is not saying that Party A or Party B had to die in order for the covenant to be brought into effect. On the contrary, the animal had to die in order for the contract to be brought into effect, and Party A and Party B had to both agree that they too must take on the punishment of death if they break their part of the contract. They didn't have to die that day when the contract was actually being enacted. In fact, if they did die, then the contract would have started and ended on the same day, because there'd be no Party A or B anymore. One of them would have died. So this is the way we understand the passage. What we're going to go on to find out, and we'll look at this next week, is that the death that actually took place in the new covenant by Messiah is the substitutionary payment. It's the second death. Yeshua's blood actually is the first death as well. He ratifies that. But more important to the writer is that Yeshua's blood is what releases one of the parties. In this case, we know it's the guilty party, which is Israel. Yeshua's blood actually releases Israel from having to die themselves, because Israel did, in fact, violate the covenant. And so, therefore, the writer is going to go to explain to us that it's Yeshua's death that not only set us free from that debt that we owed, but it's also Yeshua's blood that purified the heavenly rights, because the debt was incurred by Israel, which required a death on Israel's part. It also set into motion a defilement of God's whole system of holiness, which extended all the way up to the heavens, because God's holiness is infinite. Therefore, the sin itself is an infinite transgression, and therefore it requires an infinite life to pay for the death that was defilement that was brought on as a result of sin, the stain of sin. Therefore, purification is brought into the picture, atonement is brought into the picture, and all of that is what the writer is going to be leading us into. But in closing, what we've learned tonight is that it's not a last will and testament as seen through the lens of a Greco-Roman or even a Western point of view. A person did not have to die in order for the covenant to be brought into effect. On the contrary, the animals had to die, first of all. And number two, Party A and Party B had to agree that they would take on death representatively if they violated a part of the covenant. But in order for the covenant to actually take effect, the animals had to die. And that's really chiefly what the writer is trying to say, as well as the fact that the participants agreed to the pain of death as the punishment. And that's the force of verse 16 and 17. And with that, let's close in prayer.